Well, welcome, men. Welcome to the Man in the Pew Show. I'm your host, Phil Mershon, and this is the show for everyday men who want to follow Jesus every day, at work, at home, at church, and at play. I'm very excited for today's interview with special guest Bill Hendricks. I'll tell you more about him in just a few minutes, but first, I'd like to read a scripture for you. This comes from Psalm 8, verses 3 and 4. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? In today's episode with Bill Hendricks, he's going to talk about the unique way that God has made each and every one of us. And it's an amazing thought to me that the God who put the moon and the heavens and the stars and the sun in place thinks about us, thinks about you and me with even more care. Take a moment right now and just be thankful to the Lord for how he has made this universe and the way he made you. He did it with thoughtfulness and care. And we can be grateful to him and ask him to use us in the lives of those around us. Well, let's listen into this week's episode with Bill Hendricks. Welcome to the Man in the Pew podcast. I am excited today to be with my friend Bill Hendricks. If you don't know who Bill is, he is an author. He is a career coach. And he is just a great guy. In fact, one of the things that I love about him is he's the son of a quasi-hero in the Christian faith, Howard Hendricks. He is his son, but he's written many books, and he is the leader of the Hendricks Group. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about yourself, Bill, but welcome to the show first.
Well, Phil, it's my privilege to be here with you and your listeners and take part in this. This is really exciting for me. I wear a couple of different hats. For the last 20 years, I've had a consulting practice called the Giftedness Center, and there we help individuals think through their life and career directions. And basically, the simple way I put that is I help people figure out what they're going to do when they grow up, and everybody's trying to figure that out. And so we work with people all the way from college students up through retirement and beyond. Very exciting work to see people grasp what God has designed them to do, and then go find places to do that. And then for the last couple of years, I've worn a second hat at Dallas Seminary, where I am the executive director for Christian leadership at what we call the Hendricks Center. And so I'm working with both the leaders in training here at the seminary, leaders who are already out in vocational Christian work, as well as Christian leaders who are in places of influence and responsibility out in the work world. And so it's a pretty broad and diverse set of leaders that we deal with, but they have many issues in common, and we love to come alongside them and help them think those things through.
So one thing, men, as you're listening today, that's great about Bill is I met Bill because of the consulting work he does. A friend of mine introduced me to him back in about 1999, and I went through the process, and Bill helped me as I was trying to understand my unique design and calling, and we've been friends since that process was over, and we've had multiple times to chat over the years. So I'm excited to bring some of Bill's story to you, but Bill, I want to back way up. You grew up the son of a famous preacher, seminary teacher. But when did you actually become a Christian? And maybe give us a couple of milestones in your own Christian journey along the way.
Absolutely. I guess I could be called what some people call a cradle Christian, meaning I've been going to church since 9 months before I was born, okay? And there's never been a time in my life when I haven't been around the gospel, when I've been around Christians, when I've been around the church. And yet, having said all of that, to me, one of the most evident pieces of data that confirm what the Bible has to say about us is absolutely true is this whole thing of sin. I knew from a very early age what sin was all about, and nobody had to convince me that I was a sinner. I knew already at age 4 and a half that that I had that issue. And And obviously with the 4.5-year-old's understanding, but I'll never forget one night. It was around Easter time, and my mom used to put these, some of our listeners won't even know what these are, but there used to be these pieces of plastic. They were big discs called LPs or long plays or, you know, vinyl discs, records we call them, albums. Anyway, she put one of these things on the record player, and it was Charlton Heston reading through the Easter story. And I remember lying in bed one night, and you know, I was supposed to be going to sleep, but I could hear this story. And I was just overwhelmed with the fact that these men had taken Jesus and beaten him and then put him on a cross. And for some reason, I was just torn up about that. I was like, how could they do that to this really good man? And I remember getting out of bed and going to my mother, and I'm crying and just saying, you know, what's going on? How could they do that? And then she explained to me why he was put on the cross to take care of our sins. And it made all the sense in the world to me. And so at age 4.5, I prayed to Jesus and said, look, I don't totally understand everything that happened back there, but if you're able to take care of my sin through what you did there, then I trust that, and I want to follow you. And that's pretty much been the story of my life. Now, I'm not going to say that there haven't been some challenges along the way, but I can say there's never been a time in my life when I, you know, the proverbial rebellious streak where, you know, you go off and mess your life up and then you come back. I don't disrespect people for whom that's happened, but that hasn't been my experience. I've been fortunate to have lots and lots of mentors along the way. Notwithstanding that, I'm also what I'd like to call a recovering Pharisee. You know, some people have had those rebellious years, and some people grew up in very difficult home circumstances and come from really rough backgrounds, and God has literally plucked them out of that and saved them by his grace. But I'm a person who grew up with all kinds of advantages. You know, my father was a seminary professor for 60 years. All of my brothers and sisters are believers. My mom's a believer. You know, there's a whole sort of theme that runs through our family around the gospel. And so I had all these advantages, and I turned out to be a classic Pharisee. I mean, up there with St. Paul in Philippians 3, you know, where he lists off all of his qualifications. I'm a Hebrew of the Hebrews, you know, circumcised the seventh day, on. And I resonate with that. I could go down the list of all the things that so-called mature and upstanding Christians have and can do, and I can check all of those things off. But I had a set of circumstances back in 2000 where my first wife, Nancy, passed away. And after that, on the back side of that, it was like God just shook me to the core and peeled back these layers of Phariseeism and legalism and judgmentalism and just eviscerated me. And so today, I'm what I call a recovering Pharisee. There's a guy in the parable that Jesus told him. He was such a sinner, he couldn't lift his eyes to heaven. He said, Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner. My prayer is, Lord, be merciful to me, a Pharisee. And so I'm having to really learn grace and the extension of grace and as much as anything, the fact that my sins are not better than anybody else's sins. In many ways, they're worse. And so daily I have to come back to the throne of grace and kind of throw myself before God and say, take whatever you find here that's worthy and use it to your glory.
You know, we all have that in common, that the gulf between us and God is so wide that whether you grew up with the advantages that you have or whether you grew up not ever hearing the gospel till the day you came and maybe you're in your 30s, like one of our guests didn't hear the gospel till he was in his 30s. It's, you know, it's the same. We need that grace, and the only way we can be saved is by that grace. Bill, I'd love to explore a little bit of your story with your wife, if you will. I know that was a pretty traumatic time for you. It was actually shortly after I met you when that happened. But tell us just a little bit about some of the details of that and then how that impacted you as a man.
Well, I met my first wife, Nancy, up in the New England area. And so we married up there and eventually moved down here, back down here to Dallas. And we were together for 7 years before we started having babies. And And so, you know, we're getting our family established, and I'm getting my consulting practice going. And I will say, you know, having children certainly created some real challenges in our marriage. And so we were seeing a counselor and trying to work on our stuff, and like I think a lot of young families do and should. And just about the time the little one, she'd gotten out of diapers and she's about to turn two. And I'm thinking, okay, I think we're out of the woods. I think we can really start working on our marriage, hammer and tongs. And I just turned 40, and you know, this is going to be a great decade. And 3 weeks after I turned 40, Nancy was diagnosed with breast cancer. And she had a mastectomy and then chemo and then a round of radiation and all that stuff. And, you know, we thought we pretty much had it. And obviously that was very traumatic. But a couple of years went by and things are going great. But, you know, you have to go back in every month or whatever for scans just to monitor the situation. And a couple of years afterwards, she just felt something wasn't right. And so she went in and they do a scan. And sure enough, she'd had a recurrence. And at first they thought, oh, it's probably just some scar tissue or whatever. But when they biopsied it, no, the cancer was back. And that began a long, slow spiral that went through the next 5 years. So over about a 7-year period, you know, she just got progressively worse from that initial diagnosis. And finally, in 2000, she passed away. And I was instantly plunged into this thing called single parenting, which I don't wish on anybody.
How old were your kids at that point?
Yeah, I had three daughters, and they were 15, 13, and 8 at the time.
Wow.
And literally within about 30 seconds of her passing away, I suddenly realized, as they're asking me questions, that I'm the last court of appeal now on everything. And there's no, you know, I can't say, well, go ask your mommy or anything like that. I'm the man. I'm not only the dad, I'm now the mother as well. And by God's grace, we survived all that. I got them all into adulthood, and they're doing great today. And I remarried about coming up on 8 years ago to Lynn. And, you know, as I say, they survived, I survived. But it was a real challenge to you know, be a single parent and so forth. And of course, you have to deal with loss and grief. And one thing that's done is given me a significant amount of compassion for anybody who's dealing with cancer, but particularly for couples where the wife has cancer or the wife's died of cancer and the man's left to kind of pick up the pieces. And and there's a lot I can say about grief and loss, and how it works, and just the pernicious nature of it. But the thing that I really learned out of it, and I didn't realize I had learned this, was just how much God had shown up for us. About 3 years after Nancy had passed away, I was teaching a Sunday school class back to back, filling in for somebody. It was 2 weeks. And so the first week I talked about God's loving kindness, this wonderful truth that God has it's almost an irrational, steadfast commitment to us and our good, and gave all kinds of illustrations of that. And so it's a very joyful sort of presentation. Well, that Tuesday, 2 days after that presentation, just happened to be the third anniversary of Nancy's death. And so then on Thursday morning, I open up the paper and I find out that on Wednesday, the day after that anniversary, that morning, a little girl just up the street from where we live was on her way to school and had been run over by a vehicle. And her mother was right there with her when she got hit. And my heart just leaped up. I was just like, oh my gosh, not only did this happen right up the street, but you know, 3 days after I remember, you know, seeing my wife take her last breath, here's this mother who saw her daughter take her last breath. And my heart went out to this family. But I also knew that I was going to have to say something to this Sunday school class, because a lot of the families in that class knew this family and live in the neighborhood. But I I'm racking my brain trying to figure out, well, what do you say? I mean, how do you address it? And I had several false starts, and I couldn't come up with anything. And finally, on Saturday night, I went to bed about 11:30 and just said, oh, I'll just go by my office, pick up some notes, and, you know, fake my way through this thing. I'll teach on something else. And about 4 o'clock the next morning, I wake up out of a dead sleep, and in about 20 seconds of coming to, it was almost like a voice said, Bill, you need to say this, this, and this. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's it. I've got it. And I went in, and they gave that lesson. And basically the 3 points were what the Bible says about God, what the Bible says about evil is absolutely true. We live in a fallen world, and one of the manifestations of that is that people are taken away through circumstances like that cancer. And the Bible is very clear about that, and the world certainly gives us a lot of evidence for that, so I have no reason not to believe that. But then the second part is if what the Bible says about sin and evil is true, then what it says about God must be just as true. You can't take it as true for one without the other. And what it says about God is that he indeed is a God of loving kindness and that he's there. And then the third thing was the way that God shows up for us when we're in those kind of circumstances, most of the time, is through the presence of other people. Not so much what they say, but just the fact that they're there to walk with us through those circumstances. And all of that eventually turned into a book that I hadn't intended to write, but it's called The Light That Never Dies, A Story of Hope in the Shadows of Grief. And if anybody listening to this podcast is grieving anything, could be the loss of a loved one, could be the loss of a dream, could be the loss of a job. There's all kinds of losses, and we as a human species grieve significantly. But you might check out that book and you know, hopefully give you some hope that, in fact, in the darkness, God still is there.
I will definitely provide the link to that book here. I want to ask you a question about that time. So 30 seconds after she passes away, you realize you're the guy. And I know as a man that you love work and that you advocate that all men enjoy their work as a gift from God. And that's a big part of what your career has been. But now all of a sudden, you're left in this tension that I'm sure some of our listeners feel of how do I give myself to my career, to my work, to something that I know I have passion for and love, and also be a parent. And now I'm a single parent, so it's all on me. What are some things you learned during that season?
Well, that's a great question. I'll just point out, first of all, that when your spouse passes away, you basically get a year that I call it the get out of jail free card. People cut you a lot of slack. Mm-hmm. And it's a good thing because I'll tell you, I basically lost a year out of my life. Mm-hmm. I was fairly worthless from a productivity standpoint for a year. And it wasn't that I, you know, was sobbing and all this. It was just so much energy inside was being devoted to just trying to hold myself together and keep it all going, that I realized I didn't have much energy left over to, you know, make major advances in my career. So I dialed back my expectations. Other people sort of tempered their expectations and cut me a lot of slack. And, I did a lot of grief work that first year. From there, honestly, as a single parent, you know, the whole idea of, quote, trying to find balance, you know, in your life kind of went out the window because, in a way, I not only had my career and that work that I'm paid for, but I've got a second career that my wife had been doing as the primary caretaker of my daughter. So, you know, you're literally squeezed between, you know, meeting with people at work and dashing out of that meeting to get in the car to get there in time to pick them up, you know, and take them to a lesson or whatever. And again, you really have to dial back your expectations. You know, for some reason, your car isn't quite as clean as it used to be. Your house isn't quite as clean as it used to be. And you drop a lot of balls and you make a lot of apologies for dropping those balls. But the main thing that I committed to was to make sure that my daughters knew that just because mom was gone, they were still going to get taken care of and loved, and daddy wasn't going anywhere.
How did you express that to them?
I told them. I mean, it happened right away. Nancy passed away. The oldest entered the room right about that time, and I explained mommy was gone. About 30, 45 seconds later, this was at a hospital, the other two, the 13-year-old and the 8-year-old, walked into the room, and I turned and said, "Mommy's just died." Well, the 13-year-old, being who she is, she moved toward mommy, okay? But the 8-year-old, you could tell there was fear in her eyes. Like, she didn't know what was going on, but she didn't want any part of it. And she literally backed away. And it was in that moment I realized, okay, Bill, you know, you got to go take care of her. So I had to leave that situation, rush out of the room and grab her and picked her up. And we stood out there in the hallway of the hospital for probably 3 or 4 minutes, and we didn't say anything. We were just crying, you know. And it was interesting because the sun was setting, and it had been a rainy day, but the clouds were starting to part, and the sun was just going down, and it was just one of these tender moments. And then, Phil, out of the blue, my little 8-year-old, who I'm holding, suddenly turns to me and says, "Daddy, are you going to get married again?"
Wow.
And I mean, it was like the last question in the world I expected at that moment.
Right.
And I mean, my mind is like, well, what do I say?
Right.
Somehow, I think this was heaven sent, the thought occurred to me, Bill, she's not worried about you being married. She's worried about who's going to take care of Amy. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Amy, you don't need to worry about that. I don't know whether I'll get married or not, but you don't need to worry about that. Daddy's going to take care of you from now on." And with that, she was fine. And you know, was able to, you know, enter back into the rest of the family. I mean, she wanted reassurance that her world was not going to fall apart at that moment. And so that was my first sort of verbal way to let her know everything was going to be okay. We had another situation a few weeks later where the oldest is all fretted out and stressed, and finally I find out that she's thinking, you know, now that mommy's gone, I've got to take over and take care of these two sisters of mine. And I said, "Wait, no, Brittany, that's not your responsibility. That's my responsibility. Your responsibility is to take care of you. And my responsibility is to take care of all three of you. You don't put that on yourself." And that, again, kind of freed her from that burden. And, you know, one of the things we did, Phil, we decided, Nancy and I decided from the very beginning, the first diagnosis, that we would let the girls know everything we knew. Now, you have to be sensitive in how you let them know. You don't want to scare them unnecessarily. But one thing we just felt in our gut was, you don't do kids any favors by, you know, withholding the truth from them. It sounds cruel, but actually the cruel thing is to keep secrets, because eventually it'll come out and then there'll be resentment and anger and, you know, all kinds of questions. And can I really trust, you know, my parent, you know, to tell me what I need to know? This world is really, in some ways, very cruel. I believe it's better for kids to figure that out earlier rather than later. They're actually quite resilient. They can take hard truth as long as they know you're with them in the middle of it. And so we had lots of times where we all sat down on the bed and, you know, mommy's really sick and you know, your daughter's with tears in her eyes asking you, "Daddy, is mommy going to die?" You know, and like, well, what do you say? You know, she's got, you know, a potentially terminal illness. And so I said, well, you know, first of all, we're all going to die. We just don't know when. Mommy's very sick. We're doing everything we can to help deal with that sickness. But we're gonna stand together as a family and get her and us through this thing. And as I say, there were many conversations like that. But I think what it ended up doing, not only was it reassuring to the girls, but it was very bonding as a family. It made us much closer. And I can assure you my girls are in many ways have been much more mature than many of their peers because they've seen that life isn't always a, you know, bowl of cherries.
Yeah. Well, I commend you for just being able to have the courage and the strength to walk in and recognize what was going on and provide that assurance to your daughters. I know it required things of you that you probably didn't know were in you. And guys who are listening who maybe are in a similar situation, you know, for whatever reason, maybe you're a single dad right now. What are some words to those guys that you would encourage them with as they try to be a loving dad to their girls or boys?
Sure. I mean, a couple things, Phil. One is I talked about calibrating expectations, particularly in the early goings. To any man who's just lost his wife or a child or some other really close loved one, or maybe a man who's recently been divorced, you have to realize that you've received a significant shock to your system. Whether you feel that or not, trust me, it's there. And the way I put it is this may be over the top, but there were times when I sort of had to go a little bit crazy to avoid going completely insane, okay? And for me, what that meant was the expression of emotion. And usually after an event like that, someone will have a dominant emotion. And so for some, it's anger. For some, it's sadness. For some, it's depression. For some, it's a sense of almost meaninglessness or despair. There's a dominant emotion. And you have to sort of allow yourself to actually feel that. And so in my case, the emotion of anger, I mean, I'd beat my pillow. I'd try to vent that energy in positive ways. But I was okay about, I went on several, you know, personal retreats, and I'm out in the middle of the woods, and sometimes I just wanted to scream, and I did. I remember one day I was at a grocery store, and the line was extraordinarily long and not moving, and one breakdown after another, and I'd stood there for about 15 minutes just trying to buy my groceries. And finally, I said, you know, I can't take this anymore. And I laugh now looking back, and it created a hassle for the store, I'm sure. I just left the cart right there in line and walked out of the store. I thought it's better that I just get away from this than that I stand here and just keep fuming because I'm liable to do and say something that I'll really regret later. Well, it sounds crazy, but you're doing that in order to avoid going crazy. So the honest acknowledgement and expression of feelings in appropriate ways is one thing I'd encourage. Hand in glove with that, any man who's had a significant loss, you need to get around other men, and particularly one man who's close and that you can just vent to, vomit out feelings that you know is going to be there for you. I had a guy named Alex who walked with me through this whole thing. I mean, I had a number of brothers that walked with me, but Alex was particularly a servant in that he could see times when I'd been in all this sort of craziness with the illness and just the uncertainty and all this stuff. He'd just phone me up and say, "Hey, Bill, I'm coming by in about 10 minutes. Be ready because we're going to go see a movie." And we just go see a movie. And it was an escape. But it was with a trusted brother, you know, and so it just helped me sort of get out of my situation for a little bit. But I knew Alex was going to be there all the way through, and he absolutely was. So, I mean, those are two really practical things that come to my mind.
Yeah, and maybe that's a good dovetail into the guys listening like myself who are not in that situation of loss, but I'm sure we all know someone who has been or is currently facing a situation like that. And it's really easy for us to lose sight, you know, that the pain that person might be in or how hard it is to adjust. Obviously Alex's example is a great one that we should seek out ways that we can come in and help and not necessarily ask permission. What are some other tips that you would give to guys who are kind of looking in on a brother who's in that spot?
Well, it's all about what I call the power of presence. I think that most of us underestimate the significance of our physically being there and just being there. And what I mean by that is many times guys will say to me, gosh, Bill, you know, I don't know what to say. You don't have to say anything. You just have to be there. I can assure you, after Nancy died at about 4:30 in the afternoon, and by the time we made all the arrangements and I cleaned out the hospital room and got in the car and got everything home, you know, it was probably 9:30. And again, I'm still kind of in shock. Well, you know, here come a couple from across the alley who knew us and had been with Nancy a lot, and another couple that we'd gotten close to. We had pizza. Well, the next day, people just start showing up at my door. Hmm. I mean, they didn't call and say, oh, we're coming by. I mean, they just came. And they as soon as the door opened, they just, you know, step inside and give me a hug. And, you know, they'd usually say something like, I'm so sorry, you know, but maybe they'd cry with me, you know. And we just sit there on the couch, and sometimes nobody said anything for a while. But I had so many people. I can't remember anything anybody said, but I remember their presence forever. It's that powerful. And so just to be with a brother, don't feel like you have to have answers, because in some ways answers are irrelevant at that point. What they really want is somebody who's there to just be with them. And, yeah, you'll find some practical things. You're sitting there and you realize, you know, we got a bunch of food, but nobody got napkins. So you go and fetch some napkins, or, you know, practical things like the guy hadn't filled up his gasoline tank in, you know, a week because he's been so wrapped around the axle with this thing. So you just take his car over to the gas station and you fill it up. And you don't so much ask, you know, what do you need? Because if you ask, well, what do you need? They'll say, I don't know, or I don't need anything. You know, they're in shock. And then as time goes by, to know that they're not alienated. I think what happens in our culture for a lot of people that are, and men particularly, who go through a difficult situation, they almost become radioactive. You know, it's like we withdraw because it's painful to be with them in their pain, and we don't want to do any harm, so we tend to just find excuses not to really be with them very much. Next thing you know, the guys hadn't had a phone call from anybody in weeks. You know, he's just flapping in the breeze out there on his own. And so I think that to regularly check in with guys, to invite them to things. And one thing you don't do, I'll tell you this, one thing you do not do, certainly in that first year, you do not try to set that person up on a date with anybody, okay?
All right.
I made a conscious decision not to date for the first entire year after Nancy died. It was one of the best things I ever did. It was not for lack of opportunity, believe me. There were tons of women who were chasing me that first year. Very common for men who are widowers to get chased. And you're in such shock, you're not in a position to make a rational decision at that point. You're very vulnerable. You're almost certain to make a mistake. And just give it time. But other guys can help to, burn off some of that energy, I guess you'd say, to where the guy's not so lonely that, you know, any skirt that comes by, he's gonna, you know, invite out. He needs to heal.
Those are all great words. Man, thanks for going into that story and sharing. I do want to spend the last few minutes of our conversation here talking a bit more about your life work,
sure,
which is wrapped up in this whole idea that we are uniquely designed. And you're going to tell us the new title of your book, because I always forget it. I think it's The Person Called You, but you used to call it Why You Can't Be Anything You Want to Be, right?
Well, actually, that was a different book.
Oh, that was? Okay.
Yep. I had written a book years ago with Art Miller Jr. called the original title was Why You Can't Be Anything You Want to Be, and then they shortened it to The Power of Uniqueness. And it's still around, but about two or three years ago, I wrote sort of my own take on this issue of giftedness and human design called The Person Called You, Why You're Here, Why You Matter, and What You Should Do With Your Life. I find that the vast majority of people are, and men in particular, have at best a very rudimentary understanding of what we call their giftedness, which is essentially what they were born to do. And so they often will find themselves in work that maybe pays okay or even well, but it doesn't fit who they are because they haven't really paid attention to that, who they are. And so this book is the beginnings of how to help you think that through and find work that could prove deeply satisfying.
Is that a legitimate pursuit? I mean, shouldn't work be work, and therefore we don't necessarily find enjoyment in it?
Well, that's kind of the common thought out there on the street, is that work is a curse. It's a necessary evil. But the truth of the matter is that work was given from the very beginning. If you go back to the Genesis account, and right there in Genesis 1, you know, God creates, you know, human beings, male and female, in his image. And the very first words that he says after creating them have to do with their work. He says, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth and rule it. And this is more than just having babies. This is about having what we call dominion or authority, responsibility over the whole creation, which sounds like a grand global thing, but it's actually quite personal. It turns out that to each and every one of us, God has given a means by which we add value to the world and make it fruitful. The world on its own is not very fruitful. You know, I've never stood next to a mountain of iron ore and just seen a Mercedes-Benz come flying out of that mountain. No. Somebody's got to extract that ore out of the mountain and turn it into metal that somebody else can shape a vehicle around and build an engine. And somebody else has to get the oil out of the ground and turn it into gasoline to burn in that engine. And somebody else has to put the highways down. And somebody else has to finance all of this project. And somebody else has to educate the workers that are going to do this. And somebody else has to attend to their physical needs by way of food. And somebody else by way of medical and health attention. And somebody else has to attend to their spiritual needs. And so there's all kinds of different work to be done in this world to make the world and its people flourish and fruitful. And to each and every one of us, some gift has been given to do that. There's some way in which each of us adds value to do that. For some, it's the ability to invent new things. For some, it's the ability to get people to respond to you and influence their behavior. For some, it's about building things. For some, it's about solving problems. I mean, we'd be here all day talking about the different kinds of giftedness that there are. But every person, every man has something that he uniquely contributes to this whole project. And it's incumbent that a man figure out what that is, because when you do that thing that God has designed you to do, it turns out that you actually feel a sense of joy and satisfaction because God designed that into you. That's what he wants you to do and contribute.
How is what you're describing different, or is it the same as spiritual gifts?
Well, if you drill down on that, it's essentially the same. In my view, it's essentially the same. We're talking about the same stuff. Having said that, what I have found is that a lot of what we talk about when we talk about spiritual gifts, we've sort of received from tradition. But when you drill down into Scripture to find out where is that actually taught in the Scriptures, you run into a bunch of problems, you know, beginning with the fact of the term spiritual gift as we use it. You know, the noun gift modified by the adjective spiritual. That construction is never used in the New Testament except in one place in Romans where Paul says, I want to come to you that I might impart some spiritual gift. And it's ambiguous whether he means spiritual gifts like we mean spiritual gifts or just I want to give you something that will have spiritual benefit. So if the term itself, there's three terms that gets translated spiritual gifts. One is just the doma, the gifts. Another one is just, it says the spirituals, something that's spiritually endowed. And then the third use is the gifts of the Holy Spirit, which is like a technical term for the sign gifts, so-called sign gifts, healing, miracles, etc. I don't have a problem, you know, with people having the idea of spiritual gifts, but even the lists that are in the New Testament, none of them agrees with each other in the sense that, you know, there's one list of spiritual gifts. Paul lists a whole bunch of them in 1 Corinthians 12. You know, Peter's, he just boils it down to, you know, some of you are gifted at teaching, some of you are gifted at serving. Whatever your gift is, use it, you know. That suggests to me that these lists are not exhaustive, they're just suggestive. They just kind of, it's as if Paul's saying, you know, we have a lot of gifted people here. We got some teachers, we got some leaders, we got some administrators. He's got this catch-all. You know, we have some people that just like to help. And so there's just a lot of different kinds of gifts. Even if we said, okay, you have the gift of administration, we still have to look inside you to figure out, how do you administer the gift of administration? How do you exercise it? And so we're back to individual uniqueness. And the truth that's told from one end of Scripture to the other is that God designs people from the womb. And when you look at that design, it's almost invariably tied to purposes that God has for that person. And you realize that he has endowed them, I believe, from the womb with certain motivation and certain abilities that fit that person to do a certain function and thereby be the perfect vessel or tool for that particular responsibility. And so giftedness is an individual thing and not just, you know, a category that we throw you in.
So, guys, as you're listening to this, I think this is a revolutionary idea for some of you to realize that God made you in a very unique way. Just like you have a unique fingerprint, God has made you with a unique giftedness DNA. I don't know if you've used that term before, Bill, but it's kind of the way I think about it, is that you've got a unique DNA. What Bill does is try to help you discover what that is. And maybe in the last few minutes that we've got here, Bill, you can explain how you can help someone. What's a couple things they can even do today to discover something that's unique about them that is worth celebrating and pursuing?
Yeah, well, the way that this giftedness sort of shows itself is actually in a pattern of behavior that you come back to again and again and again and again. Every person has their own unique way of doing life. It's a pattern. And if you go back in your life and you look at moments when you were doing an activity that you enjoyed doing and you took energy from it, and you get the details of how you did that thing and what you were actually doing and what the nature of that satisfaction is, you line up about 8 or 10 of those stories, you'll start to see that there's some dots that connect. There's some things that repeat and recur over and over and over. And they do so because that's inherent to how you're wired. And in the book, The Person Called You, in the back of that book, there's actually an exercise that anybody can go through to tell stories and look for patterns. You have to go find a partner to do this exercise with. It's a lot of fun. It's very eye-opening, and it's really, in simple form, what you would do with me if you came to the Giftedness Center and I assessed your particular motivational pattern. The key is the satisfaction. You go back to moments in your life when you were doing an activity you enjoyed doing, and you don't put any judgment on it. You just say, man, that's something I got a lot of satisfaction and energy out of. And I mean an activity, not just an experience. You know, I went to the Alps and they were beautiful. No, it's more like I love mountain climbing, Bill, and I climbed these three peaks out in Western United States. And let me tell you the story of one of them because it was really challenging. And you know, you go through all the rich detail of how you did that. We're not yet, you know, figuring out how that relates to a career. But what we want to see is, what did you actually do when you were in that golden moment of exercising your giftedness? And what was the satisfaction that came out of that?
Are you necessarily looking at it as something that you do well, or is it truly just the satisfaction that's the primary criteria?
Well, in the main, when people are exercising their real gifts, there really is some productivity and, I guess you'd say, doing well. But the doing well is more as you define well. What we don't want is you go back to eighth grade and you played a clarinet solo and your parents thought it was the best thing ever and everybody else made a big deal out of it. You didn't care one way or the other. You just did it because they put you up there and you had to do it. Well, we're talking about stuff where you selected the activity probably and you kind of put your heart into it because it was so engaging for you. And, you know, and so I'll have a guy tell me about his first time taking a deer with a bow, you know, and how he set the whole thing up and prepared for that and the satisfaction that he derived from that activity. You know, I don't know whether he's the best deer hunter in the world. All I know is he did it well enough to have gained real satisfaction from the doing of it.
Yeah, I remember one of the stories that I told you, just as my example, is I spent 7 months in Kenya when I was in college.
Right.
And I was there to do research. And one of the things that I found that I actually really enjoyed was going shop to shop, interviewing business people, and then going and interviewing experts in the industry of small business development. I was there to understand economic development for how do you help the poor get a leg up? I really enjoyed that process of talking to people and then taking notes and studying it and seeing what the patterns were. And I know that helped you discover something about me that I hadn't seen. Because I think something that happens to all of us is we have that eighth grade clarinet solo, which I did. I played clarinet in eighth grade and I heard the phrase. And you hear people say, wow, you're really good at that. And you think, oh, well, that must be what I should do. Because other people have defined something about you.
Right.
And maybe internally you're like, well, I guess I can go do that because people like me for it. But you're wondering, is this really who I am? And I think what you're trying to say is you can help through this book or through this process discover what that unique way is that God designed you.
Yeah, you got to have both motivation and ability. In other words, you know, you can't just have ability and no motivation. You know, you can't just play the clarinet well, but you really it means nothing to you. On the other hand, you can't have motivation without the ability. You know, there's a lot of men who would love to throw the football like Tom Brady, you know, but this is never going to happen. They don't have the ability. But when you put those together and you discover something in yourself that you have both the motivation to do it as well as the real ability to do it, now we're getting down to what we call your giftedness. And that's an interesting story to you know, bring back about the interviews in Kenya, because here you are all these years later doing what? Well, interviewing people.
That is funny. I hadn't even thought about that.
The pattern persists.
That's maybe why I couldn't resist starting this podcast. Well, Bill, we're out of time. Can you let folks know where they can discover more about you? What's your URL or how do they find you on sure. social media?
Yeah, you can go to my website, which is thegiftednesscenter.com. And that you got to have all three words, the, T-H-E, giftedness, G-I-F-T-E-D-N-E-S-S, and then center, C-E-N-T-E-R.com. And I also have a blog at BillHendricks.net, H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S, BillHendricks.net. And those are probably the best ways for people to find out more about me. On my website, if you want to contact me directly, there's a contact page and there's a form you can just fill out. And I get people contact me all the time and, you know, have made lots and lots of new friends that way. And I'd love to hear from anybody that's interested.
Fantastic. Well, Bill, thank you for being on the show today. Really appreciate all your insights and your willingness to open up your life to us.
So, well, thank you, Phil. I appreciate your hosting this, and I love what you're doing with men.
Thank you. Well, there you have it. This has been episode 8 of the Man in the Pew Show. You can find the show notes at maninthepew.com/008. If you would, go over to iTunes and subscribe to this podcast. That'll enable iTunes to tell your friends that you like it. And then if you would, also give it a rating and a review. Those are things that help us get discovered by other people looking for shows like this. So I'd like to leave you with a thought. Bill was talking about the way men responded to him in his grief. And I bet if you think for just a few seconds, you know someone who has either lost a spouse, a loved one, or has gone through a divorce in the last few months. And I wonder, how could you be present for them? You don't have to come to them with answers, as Bill explained, but be there. Go take them to a game or to the restaurant, or if they're not in your same city, pick up the phone and call them, or write them a note and let them know you're thinking about them. And for sure, lift them up to the Lord today in prayer. With that, I encourage you, go change your world.